everyone. Thank you for joining. My name is Toni Reale, and I am the Coastal Program Coordinator for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. As part of my position, I manage a diverse network of environmental advocates, local elected officials, academics, renewable energy business owners, farmers, and entrepreneurs from Maryland to Louisiana. The Southeast Coastal Climate Network that I manage is dedicated to fostering regional leadership in mitigating and adapting to the challenge of global warming. Our network promotes protection of the Southeast's uniquely vulnerable coastal resources by increasing local, state, and national awareness of the threats and opportunities posed by climate change. The host organization for the Southeast Coastal Climate Network is the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. You can see here on the slide the URL to join the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, or if you live in Florida, our sister group called the Florida Climate Alliance. There's no obligation for participation. These networks just serve as a great way to stay informed about climate and energy issues in our region, as well as opportunities such as this webinar series. So recognizing the importance of ensuring that local communities are informed and engaged in climate preparedness, the Southeast Coastal Climate Network, in partnership with ICLEI, Local Governments for Sustainability, have put together a monthly webinar series focused on issues surrounding coastal climate adaptation in the Southeast U.S. Some of you may have joined us last month for our first webinar in the series with Dr. Lynn Carter from Louisiana State University. If you'd missed that one, you can go to SACE's website, it's cleanenergy.org, and look under webinar archives to find that presentation, which was entitled Helping Local Southeast Communities Think About Climate Adaptation. I'm now going to introduce Missy Stoltz. She is the Adaptation Manager with ICLEI, who will give a brief introduction to what ICLEI has to offer local governments in our region and throughout the country.
Thank you, Toni. Well, first of all, I'd like to thank the Southeast Coastal Climate Network and the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy for partnering with us on this really important webinar series. I'd also like to thank Harvey for being certainly the pinnacle of an iconic leader in the adaptation world. You're going to hear a lot about what's happening in Miami-Dade County, and a lot of that's been driven due to his leadership and dedication to this issue, climate broadly, both being mitigation and adaptation. Harvey's also a member of our board of directors here in the U.S., so he's been diligently helping our organization move forward. So from all of us at ICLEI, all of our members and our staff, thank you, Harvey, for all you do. For those of you who may not know who ICLEI is, I just want to provide just a little bit of context. ICLEI is an international membership association of local governments that are working on two things: climate protection, and that means both mitigation, activities to reduce your emissions, and adaptation, activities to prepare, as well as sustainable development more broadly. We are international, and we have actually about 1,200 members worldwide. Here in the U.S., we have 620 members working on climate protection and sustainable development. It's sort of a broad swath. And when I say local governments, that means any democratically appointed local government or a local government that has a democratic system can join. The cities, towns, counties, villages, boroughs, all can be members of ICLEI. And by joining ICLEI, what that means is that you get access to technical resources, trainings, information, all focused on helping you move forward with your climate and sustainability efforts, be that through building capacity, certainly via the sharing of knowledge. We've got this strong network of local governments, and we want to make sure that best practices are exchanged within that network and that lessons learned can be leveraged effectively. So we spend a lot of time making sure that our network gets to interact in meaningful ways. And the basic premise here at ICLEI is that all of the issues that we're facing we feel them most intimately at the local level. And so that's where we focus. We work at the local level. We'll partner with regional agencies, state agencies, federal agencies, and globally to help make sure that the local context is brought into all levels. There's more information on our website, and anyone that's interested in learning more about if we post this webinar, please don't hesitate to contact me. And with that, I think I'm going to turn it back over to you, Toni.
And thanks to Harvey for joining us. I'm just going to talk a little bit about who Harvey Rubin is for those of you who may not know. Harvey Rubin is the former president of the National Association of Counties and is now serving as the elected clerk of Miami-Dade County, where he serves as a county, or he served as a county commissioner for 20 years, focusing on environmental issues. Before his election to the commission, he served as a term, he served a term as mayor of North Bay Village in Florida. Harvey helped found ICLEI in 1990 and has served multiple terms on its executive committee and as its vice president. He led the CCP working group to Kyoto in 1997, where local officials demonstrated the viability of greenhouse gas efforts. Harvey now chairs the county's multidisciplined climate change advisory task force, created primarily to produce recommendations regarding what proactive actions should be taken to maximize resiliency to climate change impacts. He is spearheading efforts to have Florida become the first state in the nation to require all local governments to do both greenhouse gas reduction and adaptation planning. So thank you, Harvey, for joining us.
Well, thank you very much, Tony and Missy, for your very kind words. It's a privilege to be taking part in this today. And as I think about what you do and what ICLEI has grown to, it's quite daunting when I think back to the tender moments of birth of ICLEI back in 1990. So maybe to really understand where we are today, it would probably be informative to talk about where we came from and how ICLEI was formed and what our foundation is, so that we can really relate that to where we have to go now. As you said before, I served for 20 years at the legislative level in Dade County. Here, Miami-Dade County is a community of 2.5 million people, a very large urban area with a very diverse population. Miami-Dade County, as a county commission, we were all elected countywide in this very large area, and each of us tried to focus on different areas. My motivation for running for office in the first place was environmental issues. And so when I came to the county commission, that's what I focused on. So I was elected to the county commission actually in 1972, served there 20 years. And in the mid-70s, the issues really resolved around comprehensive land use planning, trying to put in place a plan for future growth for Dade County that would be sustainable and would be supported by the proper service levels. As information started to come out and different issues and started to form, and we began to introduce legislation, we began to link up with other city and county officials across America. And everybody listening, that was long before webinars, long before email. We would basically meet at meetings of the National Association of Counties and the National League of Cities, and we eventually developed a little caucus where we could share what each of us was doing, the latest legislation, the latest ideas that were coming from those cities like Seattle, Portland. Denver was at that point one of the cities that was in the front line of developing ideas for environment, as of course was Miami-Dade County. And when we got together, we usually complained a little bit about the fact that National League of Cities and the National Association of Counties were so broad-based that they only moved forward in their lobbying at the congressional level on issues, on a very narrow group of issues that they could get a broad consensus among their membership on. And we were not happy that cutting-edge environmental policy certainly wasn't on their agenda. So we would always kind of talk about the possibility of starting an organization of local governments that did focus primarily on environment. And at one of our meetings, I think in Portland, the head of the United Nations Environmental Program was there, and he heard our complaining and actually got up and said, "You're wrong if you want to create another organization in America. These are global issues, and you ought to be thinking about a global or an international organization of local governments." And at that point, he offered to host a meeting at the UN. And a meeting at the UN took place in, I think, October of 1990. 2 years before UNCED in Rio. And at that meeting, we brought in about 400 local officials from 60 different countries, all of them focused primarily on environmental issues. And for 4 days, we had speakers dealing with deforestation and loss of biodiversity and beginning to talk about some of the atmospheric pollution issues. We began to really start to resonate. As we've seen with national leaders, particularly at the Conference of the Parties, they have to dance around a whole series of protocols and red tapes, and they don't seem to really get down to the issues. Totally different with local governments. I found it first in America with this ad hoc group, and later, of course, with ICLEI and other groups that I've served on internationally. There used to be one called the International Union of Local Authorities. Eventually, ICLEI became their environmental spokes unit. But we formed this organization in 1990, and we found that local governments immediately bonded. Whether you're a local official along the coastal area of the southeast or the entire eastern coast of the United States, or whether you're a local official in Bonn, Germany, or in Korea, or in South America, or in Cape Town, anywhere in the world, you're dealing primarily with the same issues, the basic human needs of people. We're all doing it usually with very little applause, but we all kind of bond together knowing that we all are facing the same issues, maybe in different forms, but basically pretty much the same issues. So the desire and the ability to share at local level is much more facilitated than it obviously is at the national level. So that was kind of the motivation. And so ICLEI got started in 1990. Its first project was called the CO2 Reduction Project. And it involved 14 communities, three in the United States, I think Denver, Seattle, and Miami-Dade County were the three. A number of other, as I said, 14 total communities around the world from varying climates, varying urban, rural settings, so we could get a cross-section. And the purpose of this group was to see if they could work out local action plans and come up with some sort of a modality for how local governments could attack the whole issue of mitigation. At that point, this is before, as I say, 1992, when the United Nations moved strongly into the climate arena. ICLEI had formed this group and had actually developed 14 separate action plans using local powers, local authorities, from anything from land use to building codes. Also doing a whole range of things depending upon having to do with heat or air conditioning, depending upon the locality of that municipality. So we had 14 action plans. That was later infused into a much larger universe of local governments when ICLEI formed its first campaign, Cities for Climate Protection. That was right about the time that UNCED, or the United Nations Conference on Environment and Development in Rio, was being held. And most of you know that meeting in Rio was the largest diplomatic gathering in history. There was 191 heads of state there, and four major agreements were signed there, very high-sounding agreements, some of which have gone nowhere, and some of which have accomplished quite a lot. One was called, I believe it was called the Framework for United Nations Convention on Climate Change, and all these parties signed it. That basically created a secretariat within the UN that would be set up to deal with all aspects of climate change and to hold annual meetings of the signatories to the original agreement called conferences of the parties. And a whole series of things began to play out at that level. At the same time, local governments were spreading these local action plans to a larger and larger group of local governments, forming cities for climate protection campaigns in various countries around the world and regions around the world, to where we're pretty well covered now. Just about everywhere on the planet, there is a Cities for Climate Protection campaign going on. That campaign was structured basically around a five-step modality. The steps basically were first to do an inventory And Hickley had developed some software which lately has been greatly improved and developed, and that's available to our members. But software that would help you come up with what your inventory of emissions was at that time, so that you knew what your baseline was going to be. That was step number one. Step number two was to pick a target for reduction. How much and what percent of that inventory were you going to reduce by when? At that time, we were recommending the 20% below the 1990 levels by the year 2005. That was the so-called Toronto goal that was set, Toronto being one of the really early leaders in this area, and eventually Toronto was selected as the first World Secretariat location for ICLEI. So where am I? We're talking now about the Cities for Climate Protection campaign. So as the UN was forming its secretariat, it was made very keenly aware that ICLEI had already stepped out on this issue and was doing amazing work to begin this rollout of this campaign to attract more and more localities to get involved. You may recall in 1990 when ICLEI was formed, that was the 20th. Now we're in the 40th anniversary of Earth Day, and at the 20th, the motto was to think globally but act locally. So that was the kind of mantra that ICLEI was formed under. So we moved forward with that, and in each city that began to do the climate work that ICLEI had laid out with this five-step modality program, as they reached their milestones, they would be rewarded with a plaque or they would be acknowledged in some way. And so we've gotten two of the milestones that I've talked about so far, the inventory and picking a target. The next step is really the challenging one, I think, initially, and that is to gather around all the so-called stakeholders, bring in labor, bring in the utility companies, bring in the NGOs, bring in universities, bring in the best and the brightest in your community to start to build a local action plan using every power that you have, and also looking at some of the models that ICLEI had already developed. And now you can go on ICLEI.org and scroll into a virtual warehouse of best practices and action plans that other communities have already adapted. So you'd eventually develop a plan. The next step, of course, was to implement that plan, and every year to add and to update the plan. And finally, the fifth milestone was to quantify the results. So, you know, all this was happening in the United States. Primarily, cities were beginning to really step up, and even though in those years our national government was denying that there even existed a problem called climate. And so it was really local governments in the United States that were doing the work, not the federal government. But we were continuing to do good things and to expand. Today is we're shooting for 1,000 members in USA ICLEI, and we want all of them to be part of this program. Dade County, nobody achieved their target, their initial targets that I'm aware of, because of the advent of the SUV and a number of other factors. But the cities that were involved in the modality had a very minor increase in emissions in the first 15 years, whereas around the country it had grown to maybe a 20% growth in emissions over that 1990 level. Kind of hard to keep piecing together the local effort with the international effort, but it has to be linked in some way. Each year you'd have these conferences of the parties. I was serving on ICLEI's international board. I'm back on there now. And this was prior to 97, those first 5 years after UNCED, where the annual meetings were really kind of horrible. They ended up each time in a finger-pointing, angry crescendo with the so-called Annex I or industrial countries demanding of the developing countries that they stop cutting down their rainforest, that they they stop using fossil fuels, that they do a whole range of things, and their response was, wait a second, what are you doing? You're the ones that have caused the problem. We're not doing anything until you show us that you're willing to take the first steps. So finally, in 97, the Kyoto Protocol was under consideration in Japan, and ICLEI sent a group from the various city for climate protection campaigns around the world. We had a working group made up of about 40 people. I chaired that group, and we went to Kyoto, and I think we had a dramatic impact there. Because as we would travel, as we would meet with the various national delegations, and they would complain, well, this can't be done, we could point to a city in their country or more that was already doing it and getting great results, creating a more livable urban economy, environment, and creating jobs in weatherization and in other areas, and beginning to have impact on emissions. So it kind of broke through the kind of hard stance that many of these countries were taking, and I think that was one of the factors that pushed through and the Kyoto Protocol was passed. But keep in mind, the Kyoto Protocol was really a baby step. It was 7% reduction over 1990 levels by the year 2012. Well, we know now that, you know, that really was done primarily to bring in the developing countries and start having the kind of meaningful discussions at these conferences that would eventually develop into an all-inclusive commitment and global agreement for local governments and national governments to aggressively seek reductions way beyond the Kyoto Protocol reduction. So that takes us through 97. As we move forward, we began to realize that even if we were able somehow magically to wave a wand and eliminate the burning of all fossil fuels globally, that won't entirely solve the problem. It may certainly solve the problem of making keeping things from getting worse, but when you think about it, we've already bought decades of sea level rise, of spread of tropical diseases, of a whole range of changes in climate that affect food supplies, et cetera, as a result of what we've already put up there. The emissions that left the tailpipe of the Model T Ford in the early 1900s are still up there trapping heat. So within the United Nations, they moved forward after Kyoto, and finally, as we move forward, the scientific wing of the UN Secretariat, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, started to issue its assessments, and finally, the most recent assessment in the year 2007 really finalized the whole debate on whether or not this was happening and whether or not it was a human fingerprint. And I think that that's something now all of you that are listening probably are aware of the depth and breadth of the scientific consensus here. Not to say that there aren't some critics out there. And more recently, we've seen a rise, almost a rebirth of some of these critics. I have my theory as to why they've suddenly come back to the scene. But the arguments they're making are really easily dispelled, I think. And we should move forward with the idea that this is real, it's not political, it's a moral issue, it's something that we are committed to for the future of our planet and for the presence of our planet, getting back to the issue of adaptation now beginning to surface sometime after, I'd say around 2002, 2003, it began to be clear that mitigation alone was not going to safeguard America. And particularly those communities like the ones that I've mentioned that were already engaged in this work, we had been convinced that these impacts were coming if we didn't take mitigation steps. And now that we realize that would not eliminate the threat from our communities, we certainly had a duty to start thinking about how we could make those impacts, soften those impacts in some way, make our communities more resilient. And so the idea of adaptation began to surface. And adaptation originally was not met with a lot of warm fuzzies by the environmental community, because the initial reaction was, what do you mean adaptation? You're giving up on mitigation and you're just going to move to adaptation? Not so. They go hand in hand. We have to step up every mitigation effort we can, but at the same time, we have to keep a focus that no matter what we do, we're going to see sea level rise along the coast of our country. We're going to see a whole range of things happen that we've got to take affirmative steps, proactive steps now. And if we don't, you know, what are they going to think 15, 20, 30 years from now when they start to see these things really have impact? You know, what were we thinking back in 2010 that we didn't take steps that we knew we had to take? So the issue now was, how do we structure ourselves? How do we actually do this? So in Miami-Dade County, we already had this plan that we were implementing for mitigation, and we then proposed that there be a task force set up to continue the mitigation effort, but to greatly expand and investigate and get into adaptation as a major thrust in terms of what South Florida is facing. And, you know, it's not just South Florida, it's the entire coast. South Florida has some unique aspects. Our soil is very porous. It's basically limestone. So we don't have any prospect that we can keep sea level back by putting up dikes because it'll just rise in our water table. The most recent assessment by the IPCC actually designated South Florida as the most vulnerable place on the planet when you factor in sea level rise elevation with the amount of built environment. There's many trillions of dollars in homes and roads and buildings of all types in South Florida that would be subject to inundation. So that's an issue. As our sea level rises, many communities, and South Florida is certainly in the forefront of this, get their drinking water from a subterranean aquifer. Well, as sea level rises, we're going to see the prospect of saltwater intrusion being forced into our aquifers, destroying our source of water. So certainly one of the things that we're examining, and I'll get into the whole structure of this adaptation task force that we have, is to look at the possibility of either moving our well fields further west, which probably won't be the answer, or maybe building desalinization plants. And it takes time to do that, to plan and to site and construct a desalinization plant, probably is a 10-year minimum operation. So we don't want to lose much time in looking at the whole range of issues that we have to for adaptation. So we went to the county commission here, where I had served before. Because in 1992, I left the county commission, and I'm now the county clerk, which includes the courts, the board of the county commissioners, the recorder's office, a whole range of other functions. But the county wanted me to stay active with this issue, so I was asked to chair this task force as well. And I'm delighted to do it. It's really where my heart is. So we started to think about how we can organize a task force to look at adaptation. The task force, many of the people that are on this task force were on the original group that came up with the mitigation plan that was part of that CO2 reduction project, the plan that resulted from that. So we brought again people from the universities, people from the various stakeholder groups, and we were able to bring in some really outstanding people, and I can just touch a little bit on some of them. And then we created a committee structure within a task force. The task force was created by ordinance and appointed by the county commission here, and they really drew from the list of people that had been active in an ad hoc way in all the work that led up to the 2006 area when we eventually passed this ordinance to create the adaptation task force. So we created different committees, and the first committee is the science committee. It's chaired by the head of geology at the University of Miami, a fellow named Hal Wanless, who is considered the leading expert, certainly in Southeast, on sea level rise. He's been watching it and tracking it for something like 25 years. So the work of the science committee was basically designed to produce a report that would then inform the other committees that were looking at various aspects of adaptation, so that they knew what the recommendation from the science committee was that they were looking to adapt to. One such committee was a built environment committee to look at how we should be adapting our built environment, our infrastructure, the whole concept of facilities within the county that service the public, what the impacts would be there and what steps we needed to take. That is being chaired by Elizabeth Platter-Zyberg. Some of you may know of her work. She and her husband, Andre Dwani, are the founders of the New Urbanism movement that's seeking to move us away in our urban areas from planning around cars to planning around people. So she's chaired that effort. We have a Natural Systems Adaptation Committee that's chaired by the Executive Director of Everglades National Park, a fellow named Dan Kimball. And that's looking at what's going to happen in our natural systems, both human and animal life and plant life, and how we should be looking at what we need to do as sea level rises and how other impacts are going to hit our area, how that will affect our natural systems. We also have a Economic, Social, and Health Adaptation Committee to look at what steps we need to take in that area. We also have, in continuing our efforts to mitigate, we have a Greenhouse Gas Reduction Committee as well. And these committees, each of the chairs, which are each of them appointed members on the task force, then form a steering committee. And we've been holding meetings of these committees, and the structure in the committees is just about anybody, and as they move forward and they discover more stakeholders are brought into that process. Some of the committees of the task force have as many as 50, 75 people that have been coming in and out of those meetings. And they hear presentations relevant to their areas, and their mission is to come forward with recommendations. So at this point, and I've been talking for a long time here, maybe we need to go to questions pretty soon, but let me try to wrap up my part of it.
We have about 5 or 10 more minutes.
Sorry. Okay. All right, good. We have issued the first round of recommendations, with 35 separate recommendations that came from each of these areas, and now we're issuing a report later this month that will recommend an additional 22 recommendations. And these can all be gotten, if anybody's interested in getting either the original report or the one that's now coming out containing our recommendations. The one that's coming out now also gives a status report on the original 35 recommendations. All that is available. I'd be happy to make them available. I guess, Tony, you're going to get emails from everybody there. Anybody that's interested in getting copies of the actual reports, I'm delighted to send them out to you so we can do that. What you're looking at now on the screen is this current report. And if you page through it, you'll see the 22 separate recommendations. I don't know if you want me to go into detail on those now. They're all in there. And also one of the appendixes, as I said, has a status report. Let me kind of wrap up my part by again going back to this is a global issue, and local governments are playing their role all across America. ICLEI USA sent a delegation. I also was going to Copenhagen as a member of the international XCOM, but ICLEI USA sent its chairman, Pat Hayes, myself, mayor of actually Marty Chavez, who's now the executive director, then he was the mayor of Albuquerque. Frank Coney from Des Moines was there. He's on the U.S. board. Pagin Hanrahan, mayor of Gainesville, Florida, was there. And ICLEI played a major role at this COP15 in Copenhagen. The role was basically we rented space within the Bella Center. We had major panel discussions, including such people as Mayor Bloomberg from New York, A number of other high-profile mayors around the country took part in that, along with Pat Hayes, myself, Marty Chavez, others that did that. We got a lot of media attention that kept the word out there that local governments were active. Our major goal, aside from seeking a quote binding end quote agreement from national governments, was to make sure that anything that came out of Copenhagen would underscore the importance of local government as the implementer of any actions that national governments were committing to, and the commitment also to build capacity in local governments to do this work. While we got that message out to almost every delegation that was there, it eventually did not find its way in the final accord because they really had a rush at the end, and it really wasn't that well organized. They did not succeed in a fully binding agreement. But please understand that we're talking now about sovereign national governments. There is no world court, and basically binding agreement. The sanctions are going to be more of a sort of socialized pressure or shaming countries that don't meet their commitments. But Copenhagen really underscored the fact that if we're going to get this done, it's going to have to be local governments that are going to do it. Hopefully, the accord that did come out of Copenhagen will lead to something much more substantial in Mexico City next year when COP16 is held. There were some high points. The accord was signed by all of the countries that were there. That's the first time that's happened since Rio. And every country did make some sort of commitment in different terms. China's commitment was more about intensity or per capita emissions. The U.S., you may recall, committed to a 17% reduction. But the world is now facing a very short time span between now and 2012 when the Kyoto Protocol goes out of force. And keeping in mind that it took 8 years to get enough countries to ratify the Kyoto Protocol to put that in force, and again underscore the U.S. did not ratify and did not become a constructive part of the process until Copenhagen, where our president did show up, and there was a very strong effort both before and I understand since to keep the coalition of large governments, including the rapidly emerging economies of China, India, Brazil, South Africa, and others, in the fold, so that by next year we will have much more inertia moving forward. Unfortunately, the global economic crisis has sort of sucked up all the oxygen right now, and most priorities are national and local and state priorities seem to be headed, in that area. So, that's an area that the president and the UN as well and local governments can rally around as well, because there's a tremendous job potential in green technologies, and I think that's one area that local governments are now going to start to focus very heavily on. It's not a part of adaptation, but it helps us move other issues off the table and provide needed jobs and move us closer to where we can start focusing on a higher priority basis, we being all local government, all state and national governments, on this critical issue. We may well be the last generation that has an opportunity to really impact this. I'm going to close a little bit now on, I know I'm running a little bit long, but I have to mention the fact that the UN IPCC, when they issued their report, they were predicting sea level rise, by the end of the century would reach anywhere between 1.5 to 3 feet. That did not factor in what's happening at the polar caps and the rapid reduction of reflective area on the planet. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to understand that our atmosphere contains all of the energy or the heat, and the amount of heat in our atmosphere is the net between what gets absorbed in the oceans and the land and what gets reflected out by the reflective surface. So as we are losing reflective surface, ice cap and glaciers around the planet at a rate never seen before, That has a dramatic effect on the retention of heat, and that just reinforces the greenhouse effect, and it creates this feedback loop that the more heat is kept in our atmosphere, the more rapid we're going to see our glaciers and our ice packs turn into ocean. And when you know, as that happens, that sort of feeds in again to the more heat being retained. It's a vicious cycle. We're also seeing tundra and defrost, and as that does, it releases methane, which is even more deadlier than CO2, although it doesn't last quite as long. So the need to really step this up is just so great. The need to get the word out to people is so great. And I'm going to close on something that I hope you find somewhat entertaining in this very serious issue. I have a 19-year-old son, so over the last few years, I've been hearing a lot about Lil Wayne and about all the rappers, and I listen to a lot of rap in my house because of that. But I always complain that there's no rapper talking about environment. So my son and his friends kind of got on my case and said, why don't you write one? So we did, and it's on YouTube, and Tony wants to play it as I close. So, Tony, go ahead and show that if you want. You know what? We're beginning to run out of time, so why don't we just give them the link to this?
Okay, that works.
And they can see it on their own if they want. Let me close then on this note that it's very easy to get depressed and to feel that this problem is so engulfing that we may not be able to reverse it. I can't do that, and I urge all of you not to do it. Let's remain positive. I kind of like, in a way, to look at climate as a blessing in disguise, maybe. You look at humankind, we've evolved a lot in terms of our technology, in terms of our information. Maybe emotionally we haven't really evolved that much. We still have amazing problems, and we haven't been able to really form the kind of lasting partnerships and approaches that can bring us together on this planet to solve all our problems. So let's just assume now that we can get this together, and that somehow we do the things that all of us know have to get done. And somewhere around 2025, 2030, we start to see the ice packs starting to build up again. We start to see sea level rise receding. What an amazing effect that could have upon humanity. To see that we could take collective action and actually get results and solve a problem that we thought was unsolvable. Well, if we can do that, at that point we'll have in place all of these wonderful partnerships that help do that. And those partnerships can start to deal with hunger and crime and poverty and disease and hatred. Because if we can solve climate, there's nothing we can't do.